So I found the website, I filled in a medical form and sent it off. I received a player's pass and jumped in at the deep end and signed up for a tournament. And we went on a little adventure and I met some absolutely amazing people. And I often talk about various points of disabled golf I've played in, but it was quite life-changing. I met a lovely Danish player called Meta, who turned around and said to me, "You're part of our family now," on the first tee. And from that, I met some English guys at this tournament who played disabled golf, found out that there was a England Golf Disabled Championships, and just found out more about this world.
Welcome to this episode of the Wild Golf Podcast. I'm your host, Michael McDonald. My guest today is Amy Bullock. Amy is a world-beating disability golfer and director of golf development at EDGA, a not-for-profit volunteer organization that promotes golf for players with a disability at every level and aims to encourage golf to be fully inclusive. We follow Amy's journey from active multi-sport athlete with her own thriving accounting practice to dabbling in golf, a sport she initially disliked with every bone in her body, to her eventual diagnosis of MS in her 30s. We finally end up with an extensive discussion of her many successes as a competitive golfer and her current role at EDGA, where she grows the game of golf passionately. Amy's resilience, sense of humor, and passion for golf and her role in the game comes through every step of the way. I hope you enjoy this discussion as much as I did. So, Amy, welcome to the Wild Golf Podcast. It's great to finally have you on.
Thank you for having me.
So, Amy, I'd like to go back to your early life as a child growing up. Maybe you can say a bit more about where you grew up and what your childhood was like, and whether your family was a sports family or not a sports family at all.
Well, my brother and I were very sporty, but we weren't particularly, I guess, a sports family. But I grew up in Twickenham, just on the outskirts of London. I was fortunate my grandparents lived down just outside Exeter in a little village and had a nice big field. So our school holidays were spent running around in Devon, my brother and I and my two cousins playing football most of the time. Girls against boys, always the girls winning because we were a bit older. So yeah, so I just played loads of sports. My brother and I were permanently in our back garden. We could play cricket, football, tennis in a very small space.
Was there a point where you started focusing on one or two sports?
My headmaster at primary school was very keen on me doing throwing sports. So I was proud to say I was Richmond Borough School Rounders ball throwing champion, age 10 or something. So he was keen for me to do some more javelin and discus type activities, but I wasn't very good at them. But I really loved playing hockey. And in my first year at secondary school, the teachers suggested to my parents that I joined a hockey club. And we rang around quite a few, and there was only one or two clubs that would take an 11-year-old back in the sort of like 80s. So I joined them, and just that's all I played. Loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I think there's something about team sports as well that's quite special when you're growing up.
Yeah, I did the banter and I've always liked being part of a team and the banter and just the sort of joint success that you get from all of that, really.
And at what point did you first dabble in golf or pick up a golf club?
So I had lessons when I was at school, aged about 16. I was doing my GCSEs at the time, and our PE lessons were a bit more adventurous than just running around the school field and things. So I went to Sandown Park for some golf lessons in the school minibus, and I absolutely hated it, if I'm honest. I'm right-handed, so they'd have given me a right-handed 7-iron, and I hated it. So I just thought, this is not a sport for me. People always are amazed because I played hockey, and it's swinging a stick to hit a ball. It's swinging a stick to hit a ball for golf, but I just couldn't get to grips with it at all.
Yeah. No, because I played ice hockey and I was right-handed, and I'm a right-handed golfer. But I certainly know there's a lot of ice hockey players, you know, they hit right-handed hockey, you know, for ice hockey. But you can go left-handed, whereas I think for field hockey or hockey, as you call it, it's only right-handed.
Yep, it's only right-handed, yeah.
Yeah. And so when did you actually see a left-handed club for the first time then?
So my brother ended up dabbling in golf, and he ended up with a left-handed set of golf clubs somehow. I think when we were kids, we did play a little bit of cricket as well. My dad batted left-handed, and we kind of followed that sort of stance of playing, I guess. So my brother ended up with some left-handed clubs. So later on in life, when I was asked if I fancied playing golf, and I was like, well, I haven't got any clubs. Oh, borrow my brother's. It'll be a bit of a laugh. They're left-handed. It just seemed a little bit easier.
And through your teenage years and your, you know, growing up at home, what sort of role did your parents have in your life and your sporting life?
I think my parents might be a bit ashamed if I say this. I suppose it was some good life lessons in amongst all of this. My parents gave me money for the bus and to pay my hockey match fees and set me on my way, kind of thing. So I used to hang out at the hockey club a lot as I was growing up, and as I got into sort of like early teens and things. Yeah, but my parents sort of like, you get yourself there, you get yourself home. And then they got a bit more interested and they started coming to watch. And I think they quite enjoyed it.
It sounds like they were supportive, but without being like, an interfering, you know, sporting parents.
Yeah. Yeah. They kind of let me get on with it, really.
And then sort of moving ahead a little bit, my understanding is that you did all your accountancy training and, you know, you go through your 20s and 30s, you know, working hard as an accountant at some point, you know, setting up your own accountancy practice. And were you still playing a lot of sports during that period, whether cycling or hockey?
Yeah, so I was still, during my accountancy, I was still, and when I was training, I was still playing a lot of hockey. I played for a team that were in their first team were in the National League, and I was sort of in the second team, borderline first team. So I spent quite a bit of time traveling to matches for the first team and not playing. And that took up a lot of my weekends, and my accountancy studies suffered hugely, so to speak. So I decided to drop down a level of playing sport to concentrate on my career and my exams, but still play plenty of hockey. And did that all the way through, really, working and setting up my own business. It was a great sort of release from life and working life to be able to get out there, play hockey and have a bit of fun and some banter with the girls.
And so did you start out at one of the big accounting firms and then eventually decided you wanted to set up your own practice, or how did that come
No, completely different. I started out in a really small firm.
Okay.
And it was like a nice little family unit of people working together. And I passed my exams and I decided perhaps I should experience something a bit bigger in the world, and joined a medium-sized firm. Which was a great experience. And I got to know some really interesting characters, and I got a bit of an interest for the medical sector, GP surgeries. It was quite a niche market. And a GP friend persuaded me that wouldn't it be amazing to set up your own practice specializing in GPs and in a real niche market. So I thought, well, why not? Let's do it.
At what point did you first have or first show symptoms of what eventually was diagnosed as having MS?
My first symptom was an issue with my eyesight. So I woke up one morning and you'd have thought I'd been out on binge drinking all night. I felt shocking. I hadn't had any alcohol the night before. I felt absolutely terrible. The sort of daylight seemed really bright. I drove to a client, nearly crashed the car on the way. I just, like, the traffic lights were just really disorientating and things, and spoke to a couple of people who all thought I was having perhaps a migraine, because I had similar symptoms to a migraine. Never had a migraine before in my life, so that seemed quite good. A GP client gave me some quite strong painkillers, which seemed to help, and but I just didn't really ever quite feel the same after that. And it was Thursday of the Easter weekend, and it was my father's 60th or 65th birthday. It must be 65th birthday now. And we went to, as a family, we went to a hotel just outside Longleat Safari Park and had a family weekend away. And I felt awful the whole weekend, just really, really terrible. And on the Tuesday after the weekend, I went to the doctors, and was really shocked when they asked me to read the eye chart and I couldn't see anything out of my left eye. And they sent me off to hospital.
Was it diagnosed right away as MS?
No, it wasn't. So at the time, it was, I was at the hospital and I had loads of tests and was told that I'd kind of like had some eye episode. Nobody was really quite sure what it was. I'd need to have further tests. And fortunately, I had private medical insurance, which I was able to utilize. There's a really good private eye consultant and private neurologist, and who both indicated that this is quite a classic symptom of MS, but I didn't have any other symptoms and my brain scans were completely clear. So at that point, I was just I was diagnosed with what they call a clinically isolated syndrome. And so it could be a one-off. And at that point, nobody was going to really know whether it would be or whether any time would tell whether it was a one-off or would develop into something else.
And my understanding, too, is if it's just one episode, and if you aren't showing any, I guess the phrase for it is, I guess, scarring in the brain tissue, then it might never become MS.
Yes, I think at the time my neurologist told me, I think it was something like, he's very good at this sort of stuff. He says one in four would go on to develop MS, but obviously nobody's that statistic. It will either happen or it won't happen. So it's quite helpful at telling you your odds, but it's in like all these things, they're quite meaningless. It will either happen or won't happen.
And then after that first episode, did you just sort of throw yourself back into life as though nothing had happened?
I did. I went a bit mad, I suppose. Well, not really. I probably went a bit too hard at a few things. I took it easy because it was quite a shock, and not being able to see out of one eye, which took a year to pretty much recover back to normal, was quite hard going. I did started doing some cycling, and that was quite hard going because if I looked over my shoulder one way, I couldn't see anything. So I was a bit of a liability, but I still wanted to do it. So I kind of carried on. And at that point, I decided to give up playing hockey. I'd had my brother and family had taken me for a picnic to cheer me up, and we were playing cricket, and my brother hit the ball at me to catch, and I went running to sort of greet the ball, and it just sailed over my head. And I thought, I've got no real perspective here about sort of like balls flying at me and things. And I just decided that hockey was perhaps a bit too dangerous at that time to be playing with only one eye. So I sort of retired from that sport and immediately started playing golf.
Right. Wow. And so you started playing golf then before you were sort of formally diagnosed as having MS?
Yeah, I kind of played a little bit in the summer if the weather was nice. On the odd occasion, maybe once or twice a year. Just after the eyesight problem, a friend said to me, did I fancy taking an afternoon off work on a Friday and playing golf? And we went to a golf club called Sunningdale Ladies. And I played 18 holes. And 2 weeks later, I joined as a member.
So what drew you to golf at that stage? Because obviously, when you tried it earlier, you hated it, in part probably because you weren't swinging from the side of the ball that was most comfortable for you. But what about it, you know, really drew you to it at that point in your life, given everything that was going on?
I had a couple of friends that played that had dragged me along, and it was good fun, and I enjoyed their company. So it was just great being outside in the fresh air. I could cope with my eyesight issue much better. It's a stationary ball. I've only got to worry about myself. All these things that are that my health condition was, or at the time, was causing issues with. So it just seemed, I thought I should be quite good at it because I was good at hockey.
Yes, yeah.
I tried a bit harder, but it was just nice to be outside having some fun because nobody was that worried about how well you played, and having a glass of Pimm's afterwards on a Friday afternoon seemed like quite a nice way to spend a Friday.
And then how long did it take then from, you know, the first episode, and it took a year, you know, maybe with your eyesight issues to calm down a bit, but between that and the formal diagnosis, how long of a period was that?
So it was almost 4 years between my first episode and being formally diagnosed. I had a year of recovering from the eyesight, and then life began to settle down quite a bit. The longer I got away from that day, the sort of you thought, oh, there's more hope of kind of nothing happening further sort of thing. And then my eye started to play up again, which I hadn't really thought too much about. But I just, it's hard to explain, but on the golf course, I spent the whole time taking my shoe off, putting my shoe back on again, fiddling with my sock. And I was just like, there's just something not right here. And I ended up ripping quite a lot of socks out on the golf course as I was tugging at them. It turned out that it was nothing to do with the shoe or the sock. It was all to do with my foot. And I was having funny sensations and funny tingling and pains in my foot that were nothing to do with shoes. So I went back to see my neurologist again at that time, who then ran further tests. And this time I had lesions and scarring on my MRI brain scans. And I'd shown I was having other symptoms and things. So I went through the process at that point of being diagnosed. Again, I was lucky. I still had my private medical insurance and they were prepared to cover up until diagnosis. So I was able to mentally, I wanted to do this. I was able to push through having all the tests I needed to have done so that I could be diagnosed before my 40th birthday. So I could draw a line at my 40th birthday and start to celebrate being 40 and not still have that hanging over my head, so to speak.
And for, I mean, I know a little bit about MS, or I know people who've had it, and it's only by, you know, preparing for my interview with you that I would have read a little bit more about it, of course. But for people who don't know enough about it, what exactly is it? And I also understand that it affects everybody differently, and there's, you know, it can be different types of MS, or it goes in different stages. But for you, what was it like, you know, emotionally, mentally, to experience it and having that happen to you at that point in your life?
When I look back, I think it was quite an emotional experience. I didn't give it enough credit or respect, I suppose, at the time. Because my first episode was in my left eye, my second episode was in my right foot. There was this like sudden realization that actually it was completely in my body, in my world. I think it's probably not how you should describe MS, but to me it was like, okay, so it's affected top left, bottom right. This is like throughout my body now.
It feels like it's from head to toe, basically.
Yeah, kind of thing. And so I didn't give it the respect, the diagnosis that it needed. I tried to pretend that life was normal. My neurologist had spoken to me about be careful who you tell, because people associate people with MS, or the world associates people with MS quite a lot, as somebody who's in a wheelchair that has difficulty walking. And there is a whole spectrum to MS. And so I was quite careful at the beginning, and that may well have been a bit of a mistake, because I kept it quite to myself and tried to make out to the world that there was nothing wrong with me and I could carry on as I was, which was, I think, on reflection, quite a mistake.
And what sort of support did you have, you know, with your, you know, your parents, family at that time as well?
Great support from my parents, friends and my family. I think it was quite a shock to all of us. My mother is quoted when I first had my eye problem as saying to me, I know it's really bad news, but you're just going to have to get on with it. Which she's just like, did I really say that? But I think it was quite a shock to everyone. But family and friends have been a great support. My grandmother had a autoimmune disease as well. So we'd seen and experienced what that was going to be like, really. But yeah.
And how long did it take before before acceptance kicked in? Because as you say, there's probably a bit of denial at first, and maybe even a bit of anger, why me? But at some point, it sounds like, maybe with advice from your mother, to get on with it.
Well, I think I'm quite, now I look back, I'm like, I at the time I was very much, I was born with this. It something needed to happen to me to trigger it to sort of come out, and I was just going to have to deal with it and kind of get on with it. I threw myself into road cycling and competed in the London Ride 100 in the first year. And despite cycling like mad on a Sunday and going to bed thinking, I'm so exhausted, will I wake up in the morning? I persevered and carried on with all of that. But I think the real turning point was I started on some medication, which was, they were injections. And the medication suppresses your immune system, so you have less MS attacks and episodes. But the side effect of the medication was it gave you flu-like symptoms for 24 hours after having the injection without having the flu. So I would have 24 hours of aches and pains and feeling really tired, not able to sleep. And the sleep deprivation and the MS tiredness sort of compounded to each other to a point where I got really, really down and depressed and felt, not suicidal is not the right phrase, but I was on a plane coming home from a holiday and thought to myself, if this plane crashed, I don't think I'd care. And spoke to somebody about it afterwards and was quite upset and in tears. And at that point, I went and sought out some counselling, which is, I wish I had done perhaps earlier. It took quite a bad experience with medication to really make me sort of stand up and deal with it.
And how were you dealing with your accountancy practice? Because you had your own practice, you know, your GP sort of specialist practice going, you know, full guns at that point as well.
So I was, yeah, working ridiculously hard. I was doing 60-hour weeks on top of everything else. So yeah, it was beginning to all really take its toll.
At what point did you start looking at, you know, golf a bit more and then, you know, seeing how you could deal with having MS on the golf course?
It was probably around the time it was announced that golf was going to be in the Olympics. I was off work, having had quite a bad MS episode. And I started just doing a bit of Google searching, thinking, well, if golf's in the Olympics, maybe it'll be in the Paralympics. And what does that mean? And I was also looking at, I was cycling and what that might mean as having MS and cycling and all this kind of stuff. And I stumbled across some bits and pieces to do with disability golf. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, wow, this is quite interesting.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you found out about EDGA and disability golf. So that was doing some research.
Just a pure Google search, and it came up.
How has your relationship with golf changed then from start to where it is now? Because I know with, you know, some people I've interviewed, because they either had health issues or addiction issues, it came to a point where golf almost became their medicine.
Oh, it's definitely changed. I'm not sure I wouldn't say it's my medicine. I obviously just dabbled. And then my golf handicap was like 27, 28, and never thought it was going to ever get any better and things. And then I started to play quite well, and I got quite serious and quite competitive about it, if I'm completely honest. And it fulfilled I'm quite a competitive person. And so it ticked quite a lot of boxes in that way. And I suppose if I talk about how I am today as a golfer compared to, or what golf means to me today compared to then, I mean, it's consumes quite a lot of every part of my life, I suppose. It's the best. It gives me so much pleasure and joy.
How do you manage yourself having MS then in terms of when you play a round of golf or a competitive round? And as well, how do you manage yourself in terms of how you practice and how much you practice?
So there's a lot that goes on in the background or that people just don't see. So I'm playing golf tomorrow and I'll turn up and I'll play, but obviously chatting to you today, but the rest of the day I'll be resting up. I want to go tomorrow and enjoy my golf. So I have to be really careful what I do in the lead up to that. And then the following day tends to be a bit of a write-off in my life. So I have to plan sort of my energy levels and what I want to do around the days before and after that. So people don't see what goes on to make that happen.
And so sounds like fatigue is the big issue. And I also understand from some of your other interviews that, you know, you really have to manage, you know, hydration and food intake, not unlike a, you know, endurance cyclist. And it can be particularly difficult, you know, for you on a hot day in particular.
Yeah. I mean, on a hot day, tomorrow's forecast to be quite a warm day.
Yes, it is.
With MS, some people, which I do, have issues in the heat, and it can make your symptoms exacerbated and worse. So I need to be careful tomorrow. But I'm a big believer. When I was cycling and I was training for the cycling, I went to see a sports nutritionist, mm-hmm. because I wanted to make sure that I was eating and drinking correctly for, at that point, cycling, but just in general day-to-day life, so that I could, I wouldn't wake up and go, God, I feel terrible today, because I'd eaten badly for the last few days. I wanted to make sure that if I woke up feeling rough, it's because I've got MS, but I'd done everything to make sure I was keeping myself on a even keel, I suppose.
And how was the pandemic for you then? I guess, did you have to isolate for a good part of it because of...
I was put on the extremely vulnerable list, but I quite honestly would say that being at home in lockdown has been really, really good for me. Really good for me. The MS things that are hard going for me are communicating with people is quite tiring, being in a group of people is quite tiring, driving around, all those things, day-to-day life things that you think about, I actually find quite tiring and impact me quite hugely. So to be at home and speak to the wife and walk the dog and not have to interact with the world was really good for my health. Really, really good for my health.
It was a good pandemic for you.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I'm quite open to say that. Yeah,
You're not the only person who's said that, though. I think it's quite normal for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I've got some gym equipment, so I worked really hard on my fitness in the first few months of the pandemic. So I got myself much fitter and much healthier from that point of view, and my brain was quite well rested, I suppose, is the way of describing it.
At this stage of the interview, we discuss EDGA and its role in the golf community.
It started out as the European Disabled Golf Association. It's a volunteer-based, not-for-profit organisation. It supports disability golf from grassroots right through to an elite level. EDGA works with national federations. So at that point in time, the federations involved with EDGA were all European. And then non-European federations asked to become members, and so it expanded to a more worldwide organization. And so the European Disabled Golf Association became EDGA for short, and was therefore known as EDGA for the future. So it's got a bit of history for Europe, but it's become a bit more of a worldwide organization, and it advises the RNA, the IGF, European Tour, LET on all matters on disabled golf, and advises PGA golfing coaches on best practices for disability golf.
Can you take us through your journey as a competitive golfer then, you know, playing in EDGA related events?
So I found the website, I filled in a medical form, went to see my neurologist to get him to sign it all off and sent it off, received a player's pass, and jumped in at the deep end and signed up for a tournament. Having not really known anything about the world of disability golf. So I signed up to play in a tournament. My best friend said, well, you can't go on your own, I better come with you. So she came and caddied, having never, I think, ever stepped foot on a golf course, mm-hmm. even really knowing anything about golf. And we went on a little adventure, and I met some absolutely amazing people. And I often talk about various points of disabled golf I've played in, but it was quite life-changing. I met a lovely Danish player called Meta, who turned around and said to me, you're part of our family now.
Wonderful.
On the first tee. And I started from that. I met some English guys at this tournament who mm-hmm. played disabled golf, found out that there was a England Golf Disabled Championships, and just found out more about this world.
And that we weren't alone.
Yes, correct. Yeah, and to have a Danish friend who's Meta suffers from cerebral palsy. It's not the same as MS, but you know someone that struggles a bit with certain things in life, and it's not just you, and there's other people you can chat to about what goes on in your body and how it affects you.
And did she become like quite a good mentor for you then early on as you started playing more competitive golf?
She won the tournament we were playing in, so she became a bit of a hero, aspired to hit the ball as far as she did and play as well as she does. Yeah.
From your first event, did you set goals for yourself fairly quickly? Because obviously your journey as a disabled golfer has been incredibly impressive, getting to a point where I think you're ranked 67th in the world, which is not just women, that's male professionals. And I think third best in the world female.
I probably didn't set myself any goals at the beginning. It was just, let's see what where this goes. My golf handicap at that point was still, I think, maybe 13 or 14. So I didn't really think of myself as a elite type golfer. And then I found out about the world rankings and things like that. And I'd had some quite disastrous tournaments. And it's hard to travel abroad when you've got MS, you get very tired. And it's like three practice round, then two competition rounds. It's playing 3 days in a row. So that's has its own issues for me anyway. I found myself somehow being selected for the elite England disabled golf training squad. And I then suddenly sort of started to think, well, maybe if I took this a bit more seriously, there might be a bit more to all of this. And I've always wanted to compete at the highest level. And suddenly I thought, well, actually, maybe rather than just be the sport where I play, have a nice time on a Friday afternoon and a glass of Pimm's, it could perhaps be something a bit more serious in that way. So yeah, and I found myself reserve for the England team for the team championships. There's a gross team and a net team, and I was reserved for the net team. And I watched what went on social media at that tournament, and I was like, oh, would really love to be part of that and be playing for England in a European team championships. That would be really amazing.
What's been the biggest highlight and joy for you as a competitive golfer?
That's quite a tough question. So after kind of seeing everything that I've just talked about gone on, I decided, right, I was going to train hard. I was going to take golf a bit more seriously. And then along came 2019, which I will always say is a golfing year I'll never forget. I might be quite hard to top, possibly. So due to the world rankings, I got picked for the England disabled net team. Quite proud of that, and proud to be the first female to have played at that level for England in this tournament. I got made captain of that team, and we came second in the European Nations Cup. Fantastic experience. Very proud of all of that. We missed out on first spot by like two Stapleford points. Wow. Over seven rounds of golf. It was like, oh, I'm so close, but just an amazing experience. Really, really amazing experience. I'm proud of being second in Europe and captain of that team. And then roll on a few months, and it's the England Golf Disability Championships. I've always had a bit of a problem with these tournaments because I find it quite tiring. I found myself in second place after the first round, and so I was packed off to bed very early, wrapped in cotton wool and things. went out the second day and didn't play as well as I could have, I suppose, but managed to scrape through and finish in third in the National Championships, which
is amazing.
It's a mixed event, so I'm up against the boys as well. So, and first female to finish in the places ever in that event. So that's a pretty good, that sits up there as one of my best golfing disabled moments. But, and then roll on a few weeks after that, and I was selected to represent Edgar with five other ladies, so six of us, and we played five holes at the Solheim Cup on the final practice round day with a celebrity and a Scottish junior boy. We played off the pro tees. We had Di Doherty introducing us on the first tee, like the pros were introduced.
That's awesome.
People walked around and watched us. So that's up there as well as a pretty big highlight. I got to play with Scottish football legend Gordon Strachan, which was hilarious. Yeah. Absolutely hilarious. And we played with this amazing junior boy, and it was a Texas scramble. We birdied every hole we played, and we won and got a lovely trophy. And I followed that up with an interview with Iona Stevens on the Greens End map for Sky Sports. All of those three events took place in 2019, and all of them are, I can't distinguish between either of any of those as to which is my best moment.
Sounds like a pretty good year.
I know, mentally it's quite hard because I think I don't know that there'll ever be a year like that. So
yeah, and then obviously you've had a 2020, a bit of a write-off with golf, and then 2021 there you had an opportunity to compete as part of the Road Series. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we played in the Road Series in 2020.
Right. Okay. Yeah,
I reached out to the Road Series because it was on and I was at home and thought not really doing much. So I emailed them to see if there was any opportunities to sort of promote female disability golf in amongst their tournament. And they invited us to play in one of their events. And then a subsequent conversation early this year, they said, what would we be up for expanding it into four females playing at four of their events?
That's amazing. How did your involvement then with EDCA come about? Not as a, you know, player, as a competitor, but in terms of your current role?
A couple of years ago, the president and the, at that time, director of golf development spoke to me about perhaps would I be interested in doing a little bit of volunteering on the development side of things. So I helped out with a few bits and pieces. And then the RNA had their first Women in Golf leadership program. And Edgar asked me if I would like to apply and they would sponsor me on the leadership program, which was an amazing experience, hard going, but amazing experience. And it really set me up for, I'm passionate about golf, and disability golf has made a huge impact on my life. And I'd like to do something to get other people playing. And so it was a great opportunity. I showed quite a lot of interest and passion for what I was doing. And a reshuffle at Edgar sort of led to me being asked if I would like to join the board as director of development.
What does your role entail now? Because it sounds like, I mean, you're obviously extremely passionate about it. It's probably easy to, you know, to do that 10 hours a day. But maybe you can give a snapshot of the kind of things that you do in that role.
So, I mean, it's been hard. I joined the board last October, November time. Life is obviously with COVID, it's not been that easy. So I've tried my hardest, I guess, to try and work on things from my living room at home in a lot of ways without being able to travel too many places. So I've really been focusing on female disability golf this year. So I've been trying to pull together. There's not many females that play disabled golf that I'm aware of around the world. So we've now got a Facebook group. We're trying to pull people together and sort of raise awareness through that way. I obviously spoke to you just a minute ago about the work I've been doing with the Rose Series. I've used that opportunity particularly in England, to really push disability golf. So if I said to you, in 2016, I was the first female to play in the English Disabled Championships. This year, we had seven, which doesn't sound like many, but that's in disability golf world, that's huge. So I've been sort of trying to push awareness for that event. I've started hosted my first female disability golf day.
Great, fantastic.
A couple of weeks ago, to coincide with England Golf, Women and Girls Golf Week, try and push that as an event. And then I've been working on a couple of projects where we've been doing some community work. We go out to a couple of centres and delivered some quite basic get into golf for disabled individuals. So not golf as it's golf on a golf course or a driving range, but literally we were in a little field out the back of their centre, got plastic clubs and balls, and just using golf as a sort of an activity rather than as a serious sport, just to get people moving and coordinating their body in that kind of way. I've been working with a lady from the Blind Golf Association, just to try and support her and trying to get more visually impaired individuals playing golf, and helping her try and focus on some female projects, and just trying to support golfing federations that want to do more for disability golf.
It sounds like you're doing so much and you've achieved a lot in such a short period of time. And you're obviously doing more interviews and getting more active on social media. And the EDGA website too is fantastic. And I've seen a lot of the films that have been done.
There's loads of info on the yes. EDGA website. I mean, it's part of one of our sort of pillars of this, our three pillars of what we're trying to achieve is to increase awareness. So that you've got the Mulligan film on the website, which is a great story.
It's very inspirational to watch.
Yeah, and it's been covered by, or it's been shown by Sky Sports and the Golf Channel and other partners. And so I think it's like reached something like 130, 140 million people. So it's a great thing. And that, alongside that, we've got the Mulligan book, and there's loads of Edgar profiles about different players.
Yes, yes.
And I think they're really fantastic, because if you have a disability and you're thinking about golf, there's people there that you can sort of relate to and hear their story, and it might inspire you to want to play.
And it's not just written word there. I think there's actual interviews that you can hear, or videos as well. So it's really good.
Our president Tony has carried out a huge number of interviews. They're released every couple of weeks on our podcast, Tough Love and Second Chances.
And is there any news about the possibility of golf in the Paralympics? Obviously, it's in the Olympics. It should be. And I think because Paralympics involves, more amateurs than obviously the main Olympics for golf, which is mostly professionals, it seems to be more within the Olympic spirit than it is for the main Olympics. But is there any news or on that? It's certainly, I think a lot of people hope that it will be, very, very soon.
There is, I would say there's a lot of work going on in the background. It's a difficult one, because as we're fortunate with golf, is possibly, we all believe, Edgar, it's one of the most inclusive sports in the world. So we're very, our ethos has always been, it's about everybody always playing together. So I play in a disabled tournament against a guy that's an amputee, maybe there's somebody in a wheelchair. Everybody plays in and mixes in together, whereas the Paralympics tends to put competitors into different categories.
Yes, exactly.
So there's a gap there that needs to be bridged, I suppose. And so there's a lot of commitment, people working in the background to try and work out how to make that work. So I think we're hopeful that it might make 2028 or 2032. I'm a big believer it is an ideal sport for the Paralympics, and golf making the Paralympics would have a huge impact on the sport globally, from grassroots right up to elite level.
And so Edgar manages the world rankings for golfers with a disability. How does that, I mean, I'm sure it's a very complicated system, but how does it work? Because obviously you're doing the rankings with people, as you say, who have very different disabilities.
Yeah, so I think Edgar's started the world rankings, but it's been handed over to WAGA for them to run and manage. It's a quite straightforward, I think, process of how the points are calculated per event. We're very inclusive. So there is a gross ranking, and then there's also a net ranking. So if you don't have to be a scratch golfer to want to go and play in a world ranking tournament, there is a net world ranking as well, which will take into account your handicap, your golf handicap. So there is something else to play for, not just. And then for golfers over handicaps of over 18.5, there's also a Stapleford world ranking.
Got it. And are all the events, are they all mixed for the most part?
Yeah, they're all mixed. Yeah, men, women, wheelchair players, we all play together. Yeah, we have amateurs and professionals. We all play in the same field.
And is your competitive season then this year, is that coming to a close, or how far into the year will you go with events?
I've not done very well, I suppose, this year. It's a competitive season. We've had the Road Series events. I didn't perform to my best at the English Disability Championships, but I prioritised the volunteering work I was doing over actually playing golf and practising and wanting to drive up female participation. So that's had quite an impact. My poor performance has had quite an impact on my world ranking position.
Yes, yes, yes.
So I need to seriously think as a player what events I may well play in towards in October and November to try and push my ranking back up again.
And are there any big or new events coming up next year that wouldn't have appeared this year? So hopefully next year is even a bit more normal than this year.
Not at the moment. I'm sure there's lots of work. Everybody be beavering away in the background at things, but the schedule of events is not really released until probably March time for disability golf things for next year. So we'll have to see what exciting things might come out then.
If you were head of the RNA and you basically could govern every private and public golf course in the country, all the driving ranges, you name it. And you could make a decision and it would get implemented into the next day. What are the two or three things you'd like to do to change, you know, the game of golf from your perspective?
Wow, that's a really good question. I think a lot's been done to make golf more inclusive, but I think there's a huge amount more that can still be done. So I'd look at what perhaps could be implemented to make facilities more inclusive, maybe change people's views and attitudes. I'm not a big fan of men's captain, ladies' captain kind of thing. I think there's a lot that can be done perhaps to implement some changes in that kind of way. I'd like perhaps more women to be given opportunities, perhaps at golf clubs, to be more involved in golf clubs and running of golf clubs, whether on committees or employed in employment ways. I'd love there to be some rules and regulations that have to make golf clubs more accessible for disabled golfers. I think there's members clubs can get around certain things because they're a members club, and so they don't necessarily have to fulfill all of things that perhaps public places have to do. So I'd like to see perhaps more to be done in that way.
Would you do anything with the attire and dress codes of?
Oh, absolutely.
I think everybody would.
I think it's COVID coming along has been quite interesting, because I think a lot of people have had to change perhaps how they think about the attire and things. I mean, we at Woking, I think we can wear trainers and golf shoes in the clubhouse, which was in areas in the clubhouse, which was something that never happened really before. And they'll be reviewing what happens in the future. So I think to get a younger generation much more inspired into some of these things, I think there needs to be a bit of a relaxing of some of these things. I don't want to be told off for wearing my hat in the clubhouse. I've just got it on because I've walked in to go to the toilet and walk out again. I don't want to have to remember to take it off. There's lots of that kind of thing. I know there's last year there was lots of chat about hoodies on the golf course and things. I mean, it doesn't really bother me either way. It's like all these things, you should, when you play sport, you tend to play sport in something that you're comfortable wearing and is good. I think people should just be allowed to play in what they feel comfortable wearing and how they feel comfortable.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. Amy, finishing up with the rapid fire questions, what has been your wildest golf adventure or experience, whatever definition of wild you'd like to use?
Definitely the first ever Edgar golf tournament I played in. I signed up for the European individual championships. I hardly left the counties of Surrey and Berkshire to ever play golf. So I got on a plane to the Czech Republic. I got collected on a coach for a 2.5 hour journey, arrived in a tiny sleepy village with quite an interesting, rather ropey hotel. My best friend came with me, had never played golf, didn't really know what she was doing. We only managed 3 holes in the practice round before there was a horrendous thunder and lightning storm, and went out to play the next day. The hotel got hit by lightning, so none of the lifts were working. It was just like, wow, this is what an experience this is.
That's fantastic. And where would you go to for your golfing pilgrimage?
Having had this question in advance, I thought quite hard about, long and hard about this. Mm-hmm. So my first instinct and obvious answer to me was I'd want to go to Augusta. Mm-hmm. And then I thought a bit more about that. And actually, I decided my pilgrimage, I wanted it to be a tour of the world. And I know I have come across a huge number of disabled golfers through social media. I know a huge number of people through social media that have a disability and play golf. And I'd like to do a tour of the world and meet all of those people, because actually where I play golf doesn't matter. It's who I play golf with.
That's a wonderful sentiment. And Amy, what's your biggest passion outside of golf?
Star Wars.
Really? Are you a Star Wars nut?
I thought about that one as well. Yeah. I decided it's definitely Star Wars, but episode 4, 5, and 6, A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi. I'm not interested in the others.
And who is your favorite character? And do you get dressed up to go to any Star Wars theme parties?
No, I don't get dressed up. My cat used to be called when he was alive was called Chewbacca. My cockapoo dog is called Obi-Wan Kenobi.
That's brilliant.
And I have but R2-D2's my favourite character. On a previous interview, when I was asked if I could create a four ball and it could be anybody, any people, I chose R2-D2 as one of the players.
That's great. I imagine that was an answer that they had not heard before.
I thought it'd be quite interesting to see how R2-D2 would hold a, we could get a nice adapted club.
Exactly.
Goal for everyone.
I'm sure R2-D2 would be very good at reading greens and course management. And lastly, Amy, if you could fly a banner around the world behind an eco-friendly plane, what would your message to the world be?
I saw a post on Facebook today by a friend of mine that reminded me about something and really touched me, because she has been battling or is a survivor of breast cancer. And she posted, "Live your best life." And I thought, that's what should be on a banner. Live your best life.
Fantastic. That's a great one to finish on. Lastly, Amy, where can people find out more about you and all the great work that you do for Edgar?
If they go to the Edgar website, www.edgargolf.com, there's loads of information about disability golf there and what goes on. And there'll be a player profile about me, which has got links to how to get hold of me.
Fantastic. And I'll include all that information on the show notes. But lastly, just wanted to thank you, Amy, for being a guest on the podcast. It's clear that your passion for disability golf comes through, and I think Edgar's very lucky to have you driving that forward.
Oh, thank you for having me and telling my story.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Wild Golf Podcast with Amy Bullock. If you like this episode, please tell your friends and leave a review on your favorite podcasting service. Next week, we continue with a speed golf theme with Scott Dolly from Houston, Texas, who just broke the world speed golf record. See you next week.